unfortunately. Okay, so here we go. By way of a second piece of introduction, and that is, my position at the University of Minnesota is essentially a promote interest in NASA position, or promote interest in aerospace position. Okay, so I tell people I work for NASA, but I work in Minnesota, which sounds a little odd. But it turns out that NASA has a presence of people like me in every state, in fact, in more than every state, and I'll show you in a moment what other places there are. So I represent essentially what's called the Minnesota Space Grant. It's a NASA project. And I'm housed at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities, but I work with people around the state, mostly at the college level. So here we go. I have two titles here. Live streaming the 2012 solar eclipse from the stratosphere. That's very descriptive. Perhaps a slightly better title, for starters at least, would be NASA's Space Grant 2017 Solar Eclipse Learning Project. So what I thought I would do, actually, is work my way through one of those titles and tell you just a little bit about what the different parts of the title mean, and then we'll get to solar eclipse, don't worry. So first of all, NASA Space Grant, this is our logo. There are space grants in every state. This is a higher education program of NASA, and there are actually 52 of them. We didn't miscount. We have one in Washington, D.C., and we have one in Puerto Rico, in addition to the 50 states. And there might eventually be 54 of them. We might establish one in Guam and one in the Virgin Islands. It all depends, as is the case with most things, on money and whether or not money will be forthcoming. Basically, space grants started about 30 years ago or so with somebody complaining to NASA, frankly, somebody like a senator from Rhode Island, I mean, somebody pseudo-important, saying, you know, hey, I've got a daughter, she's in college, why are you spending all your college money, of which you have some, in California, in Texas, in Florida? And, of course, the reason was that's where NASA had their big facilities. But Space Grant was established to put some NASA money in every state to work at the college level. And so I'm the sole employee of the Minnesota Space Grant, but I have contacts around the state. So we provide aerospace-themed opportunities for college students, for college faculty, and I also do things like informal education presentations, like this one, in fact. So I work with people who aren't in currently in college, who've been in college, who will be in college someday as well. And so we technically work with 14 out of about 66 or so colleges in Minnesota, and so it's not the majority. And the schools that we work with agree to give additional opportunities to their students in the aerospace area and to put some of their own money into the skin in the game. Okay, so that's how Space Grant works. Eventually, I'm going to turn off these lights once I get to videos, but I think for the moment this will work. So now a little bit about the solar eclipse. Of course, you probably know very well that an eclipse happens, at least in an astronomical sense, when something casts a shadow on something else. Okay? So a lunar eclipse is when the moon is eclipsed, or a solar eclipse is when the sun is eclipsed, in this, and for us, by the moon. Okay? So here's actually an interesting graphic. It indicates that eclipses don't happen as often as you might expect. It turns out the moon goes around the sun. The moon goes around the Earth once a month, approximately. And then the Earth, of course, goes around the sun once a year. And you might expect that once a month you have a solar eclipse and once a month you have a lunar eclipse, and you do not. And here's the reason you do not. And that is, if this is the Earth and if the sun is in this direction, so then there's a shadow behind the Earth, a pretty big shadow, and then there's the moon and it casts a shadow. But it turns out that often, because the moon and the Earth are not lined up with the sun quite, that often the moon misses the Earth's shadow. And even more often, the Earth misses the moon's shadow. So if everything is well aligned, then you might get an eclipse of the sun right here on this part of the Earth, so not the whole Earth, but a little bit of it, or you might get an eclipse of probably the whole moon based on the shadow of the Earth. That can happen, but it doesn't happen every single time around. Frankly, there will be a few of these every year, and there will be maybe one of these every year, and if you're not in the right part of the Earth, you won't see it. Okay? So, I had to have a cartoon. So here's a lunar eclipse. So just think about it. This is not to scale at all. So if this is the sun, and if this is the Earth, and this is the moon, then basically the sun produces the light, and then the shadow of the Earth might cover the moon, and you call it a lunar eclipse. Of course, if you rearrange things and you put the moon in the middle, then the shadow of the moon might fall on the Earth, and you call that a solar eclipse, because we live on the Earth, of course, and so what we are seeing from our perspective, what is being eclipsed, in this case, the sun is being eclipsed. Of course, there is another arrangement. Apocalypse, I'm not quite sure. Don't worry, this is not It's cute. It's cute. Just some vocabulary, right? Gotta get the vocabulary out there. Here we go. So here is some key vocabulary, and that is, if you think about the moon, okay, and then the idea is there is sort of the full shadow of the moon, and if you're inside of this shadow, then the entire disk of the sun is being covered up. That's the darkest shadow. But it turns out that even bigger than that would be the parts that are somewhat in the shadow, but only part of the sun is being covered up. So that would be a partial shadow. And so the words would be umbra for total shadow or penumbra for partial shadow. And it turns out that on the Earth, this is fairly realistic, the total shadow is rather small, but the partial shadow can actually be quite big. So that's why I say that pretty much everybody probably experienced at least a partial eclipse last summer, if you were in this country at all, because the partial shadow covered the entire country. But the total shadow only covered about a 70-mile-wide swath across the country. In fact, this is, you know, could you turn down the lights right now so we can get a little bit more... There you see it. This is actually quite realistic. This is not a photograph. This is an artistic depiction of reality. And that just shows that the size of the partial shadow is actually exceeding the size of the continent. But the size of the total shadow is right in here, and it's even too small to be seen on this scale, okay? So lots and lots and lots of penumbra, not so much umbra. And then the umbra moves across the ground at about 1,600 miles an hour or so. So this was on the 8th of the 21st of August last summer. And so lights back up for now. Thank you. And in Minnesota, this is who I've mostly talked to, most of the state was under about an 85% coverage, which sounds impressive. So the sun was about 85% missing. But it turns out that even the remaining 15% of the sun is so bright that most people did not notice. Even if it had been clear, they would not have noticed. But the reason is we're used to variations in sun brightness, especially because of clouds and things like that. Okay, here in Holden Village, I haven't actually looked it up, but I suspect it was more than 85%. Does anybody know, was anybody here in Holden on this date last summer, and did anything happen at Holden because of the eclipse?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me what happened. Was there any activities, or did anybody pay attention?
Yeah, oh yeah, I wouldn't be paying
attention. Excellent.
It was partially. You got kind of rescued.
Okay, very good. Okay, so in other words, it turns out if I show this picture, this shows where the full shadow went, and notice the full shadow went through Oregon, but it didn't go through Washington, so I know it was not a total eclipse here. And it doesn't go through Minnesota either, so what I did is I chose to travel down to Nebraska and watch it from the path of totality down here, just outside of Lincoln, Nebraska. So about 70 miles wide. It went from Oregon across the country all the way to South Carolina. This coast-to-coast eclipse was unusual. It turns out that the last eclipse in the continental United States had been 1979. Okay, and so lots of people, and there have been partial eclipses also. The last coast-to-coast eclipse, I'll show you a map of that. But let me just show you 100 years worth of eclipses here. So eclipses from 1951 through 2000. And notice there's a bunch of them. This one here in particular got really close to Holden. I'm not sure if Holden is quite in that one. And in fact, it even went through Minnesota. That's what I, again, pay attention to. Notice in this 50 years, from 2000 to 2050, there are none at all in Minnesota. In fact, there's none at all in Washington State. So essentially, if you're going to see a total eclipse, you almost always have to travel. Notice the fact that these widths are different. So for instance, here's a pretty skinny one, and here's a pretty wide one. And that just means that at that moment in time, the moon was physically closer to the Earth, and hence it cast a bigger shadow on the Earth. That's all. And this is just this is not the penumbra. The penumbra is bigger than the continent. This is the actual umbra shadows. I found out, this is cool, I don't have a map of it, there is actually a total solar eclipse coming to the Twin Cities in Minneapolis. 2099. So, it'll get on the next 50-year map. Okay. On the other hand, here was the last coast-to-coast eclipse, June 8th, 1918. We should have had a 100-year celebration of that. You know, we should have here, right? Okay, this is recently. What was going on at that time in the world?
World War
I. I didn't realize you were that old. Yes, indeed. This was during World War I. The armistice was not signed until later in the year, so World War I was going on. This is the last time there was actually a coast-to-coast eclipse. There have been other ones, as I've showed you since then. Now let's get on to stratospheric ballooning before I get back to my experiences with a specific eclipse. Stratospheric ballooning, my job is to promote interest in NASA things. And so, I mean, NASA does lots of aeronautics. You don't hear about that as much as the stuff they do in outer space. And so it turns out that it's hard to put things in outer space, and so what we do instead is we pretend. And we are pretty good at pretending. For instance, if you use weather balloons, you can build what are really miniature spacecraft and operate them as such, and lift them up to heights in the stratosphere, maybe up to 80,000 to 100,000 feet. I put them higher than that sometimes. And from those altitudes, here's a photograph taken from one of my balloon flights at about 70,000 feet in the middle of the daytime. You can see the sky is black. You can see the sun. You can see the cloud-covered Earth. This is above Alexandria, Minnesota. You can see the limited nature of the atmosphere. I tell people we need to take care of that because there's not a lot of it. You can actually see, if you've got a real sharp eye, you can see the curvature of the Earth in this photograph. You just have to be careful. If you take a picture with like a GoPro camera, there's so much curvature in the camera that you'll get fooled. Uh-huh. And you'll see that the Earth is sometimes curved this way, and sometimes it seems to be curved that way, and it's like, really? But it turns out that's the curvature of the camera. This camera on the other end was a really good camera, and so it showed the curvature of the Earth really accurately. I tell people that when we are first launching our balloons, so here, these are actually middle school students, although I mostly do this with college students. The balloons are about the size of a car when we first let them go. We put enough helium into them to make sure they will not only lift their payload, but they will go up at a reasonable clip. And then they expand a lot, and eventually the balloons would not fit. If they were spherical, they would touch both walls, these four walls, all of this room, and of course extend much higher than the ceiling. You can watch these balloons 20 miles away, see them pop, naked eye. Basically, you can see something that's that big in the stratosphere, as long as you know where to look and it's clear. So we do this pretty regularly as an example of how to get students, middle school students in this case, but also college students, thinking about outer space. Why you should go there, what to do, how to survive there, how to survive getting back, that's always hard. So I don't have internet here, so I'm just going to show you a quick little video of... It was put together by, why don't you turn on the, off the front lights at least?
Just go for that.
Okay, so this building gopher is our mascot. Really, gophers? That's really dumb. But anyway, so here my students decided on a camera that was going for a flight anyway that they would put a keychain-sized Goldie gopher inside a little spacesuit, which they made themselves. And launching from southern Minnesota, and just stick them out there. And so here is Goldie later in the flight going through cloud decks. This is fairly standard if you're used to flying. You may have seen a view like this. Probably not like that. So 95,000 feet approximately, three times higher or so than planes, commercial airplanes tend to fly. See the curvature of the camera. And then the popping, you saw maybe little bits of flex a balloon. That was Goldie going to come back home then. Okay, lights again, thanks. So just a little bit about our flights. And so we are in the 127, I think was the number of our last flight. We often fly more than one balloon. So this is hundreds of balloons that I've done over the last few years. Here is just the GPS track for one of our flights. This is actually from a while ago, 2016. And so what I see here is actually the vertical ascent, the bursting, and then the coming down, and then the landing, and then the walking across the ground after picking the thing up. And this is just the ground track. In other words, what was underneath it. For those of you familiar with Minnesota, you'll recognize a few things here. You'll see the Twin Cities are up here. We're in southern Minnesota. There's Owatonna. There's Mankato. So we were flying in the vicinity of Mankato on this particular day. A fairly typical flight track for one of our flights. Now, finally, time to talk about the Eclipse project. So I was involved in helping organize a project to try and involve ballooning teams from around the country, mostly but not all college teams, mostly but not all space grant teams, to watch this event from the stratosphere and see what we could learn about the event. And I'll tell you right now, we didn't learn much about the event. And the reason, in part, was that was not the plan. The plan was to see how good we could get at getting flights up and taking certain kinds of data for a very specific event that was not going to wait. And if you know much about spaceflight and spacecraft, they always are delayed. Okay, so we had a really hard deadline. So we call this our Eclipse Ballooning Project, perhaps should have been called our Stratospheric Ballooning Project, for the 2017 Eclipse. It was organized in large part by the Montana Space Grant, but I being Minnesota, Colorado, Louisiana, these are some of the several teams that were closely involved in helping organize this nationwide effort. So here are some of the things that we wanted to do. Basically, we were trying to educate people. We were trying to involve our people in particular. And we decided this was the hardest thing we tried to do, and that was to live stream the video. We regularly put up cameras and just take pictures and then look at the pictures when the balloons pop, come down by parachute, and we locate it after the fact. That's relatively easy to do, and it's very cool. Trying to live stream the stuff and get it to the ground in real time and even on the internet in real time, that was hard. And we just put that challenge on ourselves to make it a bit more interesting for us and maybe a bit more interesting to people who are watching us. We did have people, myself included, who were trying to learn about the eclipse and do atmospheric science of various sorts. There was lots of outreach that was going on. We generated lots of cool videos. And then we actually ended up establishing a lot of partnerships, not only between academic institutions, but between us and various industries. In actuality, every single industry that is related to stratospheric ballooning got involved in this. Raven Industries, Google does stratospheric ballooning with their Google Balloon Project. They're escaping me. I have a list later on. A bunch of other industries were also involved. And so our main challenges, we're limited in how much we're allowed to lift without getting special permission from the FAA, and we wanted to keep it under the FAA regulations just to make sure that we could really operate any part of the country except for military airspace. And what it really boiled down to is the things that we needed, especially for this video streaming, did not exist. And we essentially had to develop these things. And we managed to do, we put together a system that worked some of the time. It was finicky. But anyway, so we struggled with technology. We were limited in how much money we had available for every given team. We raised some money, and SpaceGrant kicked in for teams like mine. I probably spent $100,000 on this particular project over 3 years. And that's what I do. I do projects, and so that was not out of line, but not everybody had that much money available for them. And there were regulations and bureaucracy. We got turned down more than once, and we came back, and we were persistent. And it worked out. It was a pretty good deal, and we haven't quite figured out after doing this what to do next that could be even as cool as this, but we're thinking about it. Okay, so here was the poster that was put together for this project. And it's not to be taken too seriously, but it tries to indicate the fact that there was an eclipse going on, and there was going to be a series of balloons spread over the nation in particular that were going to be watching this thing and trying to come up with a nationwide information stream. Can't read this, but I just want to point out that we had groups from all over the country, all of whom eventually lined up along that line. And so we were in Nebraska, but we had people in Oregon. We had people off the coast of Oregon to try and catch it even before it got to Oregon. We had people off the coast of South Carolina, lots of people in Kentucky, not so many people in Nebraska. And then we developed a bunch of hardware. And so here are pictures of the hardware. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. And so the way it worked was that several different space grants volunteered to kind of lead the project. And for a while, as in about a year, independently tried to work up hardware. And then we kind of took stock and then chose Montana, kind of won, and that was fine. So we ended up choosing the Montana hardware, and then we took that and we ran with it and we made some improvements to it. So this actually shows how it all fits together. So we have balloons, and the balloons are flying with payloads, and these payloads have radios so that we know where the balloons are. And in fact, the way they decided to set things up in Montana, and we ultimately didn't do it this way, was to have the GPS information not come to the ground station, but rather go to a satellite network and then come to the ground station through the internet. But one way or another, we needed our ground station to know where the balloons were so we could point our ground stations accurately at the balloons as they traveled. And then once we had our essentially radio link set up, then we could start to downlink video and other things straight from the balloons. What we decided to do is do an end run around this system and actually put GPS radios on here that would talk straight to our ground station. And once we've managed to get our first connection, which wasn't usually too hard, then we can maintain it and have a lot more updates and therefore do better pointing. So we ultimately, our team at least, didn't end up using this rather circuitous loop. But Eclipse, StreamEclipse.live, that was where the video was going to go, the live stream. And I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So here's some pictures of actual hardware. Okay, so this ultimately, we use microcontrollers, often Arduino, sometimes things like Teensys, but Montana decided they wanted to use Raspberry Pis, and so I was not actually familiar with Raspberry Pis. We had a pretty steep learning curve. The Raspberry Pi is a type of microcontroller, and so we had a Raspberry Pi that was taking video, another Raspberry Pi that was taking still photographs, and then we had two different radio systems, one able to send down video through that big dish, and then one able to send down still photographs through other kinds of antennas. They set it up so that we could, through the satellite network, actually cut things away. So if the FAA really didn't like the fact that we were flying over O'Hare or whatever, that we could actually terminate a flight early. I don't think the FAA ever called on any flights to be terminated, not ours at least. And so here shows a picture of the size of the equipment. It turns out that NASA does this all the time. But the problem with the way NASA normally does this is their balloons cost millions of dollars, and so do their ground stations. And we didn't have millions of dollars available to each of the teams that wanted to do this. So we kind of put a $5,000 cap on it. What can fly and be on the ground for $5,000? And we came up with a system that was capable of working, but just didn't work as well as it should have. And hence, we're not selling it in some sense, right? It's really not quite ready for public consumption. And here is one of the GPS trackers. This is the one that actually talked to the Iridium satellite network. So this is the original Montana design, and then they also had a website where the videos would be posted, and also a website where the flights would be tracked. And part of the reason we wanted to do this website is so the FAA could watch our balloons. It turns out that the FAA does not see vehicles of this sort while they're in flight. Basically, they don't have transponders on them, they don't have radar reflectors on them. So we know where they are, and they don't. The FAA has rules. I call them the turkey rules. Basically, if you're no more dangerous to an aircraft than a turkey, and you know there are bird strikes regularly, then supposedly they don't care. I would not want to tangle with a plane. I wouldn't win, but they might not either. And so we try to fly these things far away from airports when we can. But in this particular case, we had hundreds of balloons in the country at the same time. And the FAA was curious. Even if we were flying under weight, they were curious where we were. And so we set up a website that allowed them to look that up. So here's some comments about modifications to the design. One thing that we chose to do, this is our team, every team was encouraged to work with this design and try to improve it as they could. And so what we decided to do, among other things, was we said, now look, it's all well and good to have video, but if you're looking in the wrong direction, then the thing you need is over here, and you're looking over here, that doesn't help very much. And so we actually built a box and flew a couple of them so that we had the videos in a box, and then we had a separate box which was actually able to sense the direction things were pointing. And as the balloon rotates, as they always do, we would anti-rotate the camera box and try to keep it pointing at the right thing the whole time. It was finicky. It sort of worked, and not as well as we were hoping, but that was one of the things that we worked on. We also worked on options indicated here of trying to keep our payloads from rotating as much in the first place. That was actually more successful than they compensate for the rotation. It was just dumb with them rotating in the first place. And a bunch of other teams took us up on that and eventually adopted what we did. Some groups actually worked out with bigger antennas. We stuck with the smaller antennas, but this is Louisiana, which pulled out a rather bigger antenna and was able to get more range on that. And then we also decided on our team that we wanted to have the ability to command our stuff from the ground and tell it to do things, not just take data streams coming down. So we did that through with XB radios. So here's just a real quick summary of some of the results. We did lots of education and engagement. We got lots of college students and a bunch of high school students involved. The live streaming from the internet, or to the internet, to the stratosphere, I have that in fainter text just because that was not nearly as successful, although that was the hardest thing we tried. Some teams managed to get some stuff through. We actually had 3 live streams to the ground, and the internet was not on. I'm serious. Basically, there were internet outages over this entire swath of the country. And so the people who promised that they could post it for us couldn't post it for us. Not my fault. Well, maybe I should have, you know, negotiated harder. I'm not quite sure. But our team did not manage to post our stuff in real time. But I'll show you some of the stuff, which we did get to the ground during flight, but we did not get it up on the internet for people in Minnesota who were interested in particular watching us to see. So they were disappointed. There was a bunch of atmospheric science that different people did. And if I have time, we'll see. I might get to some of that, I might not. We did lots of media coverage and outreach events. And we did a lot of academic and industry partnerships. But we really made more progress. Actually, NASA, oddly enough, we are NASA. We're a small piece of NASA. And there were lots of people at NASA who didn't think we could pull this off. It's like, you're going to do what? For 12 pounds and a few thousand dollars? Can't be done. And we made a lot of progress. We got a lot of things done that our detractors didn't think could be done. On the other hand, we all could have used another year or two to keep working on this. So the technology, we made progress. We got things in under weight and under cost, but they were not as reliable as we were hoping. We overcame a lot of regulatory and bureaucratic issues, and we could have always used more time, no doubt about that. Okay. Oh, and one more thing that I did is, after this was over, I actually hosted a national conference on my campus We call it AHAC 2017. And so that was held in October, just a couple months after the eclipse. And most of the data that I might show you later, and I will show anybody who wants to if we're running out of time, came from this particular eclipse ballooning conference. But anyway, so here's some information about the involvement, and then I'm actually going to show you mostly videos, just because I think that's the thing that really captures most people's attention. So we had over 50 teams from over 30 states, and on the flight day, just over 50 teams actually managed to get at least some video telemetry flying and down to the ground. And pretty much everybody got really cool footage from their onboard cameras, but not everybody managed to even get as far as we did in getting some of the stuff to the ground. So when we, for instance, had issues posting our video streams. And then many teams carried additional experiments, and we had some of those on board as well. Here's some metrics. That this came out of the Montana Space Grant, talking about how this was NASA's biggest digital event ever, about seven times as much traffic as the biggest one to date, which had been the New Horizons flyby of Pluto. And so they said that they thought the audience, online audience in particular, was not too different from like a Super Bowl, maybe 600 million or so people watching at least some aspect of the streams, not only ours, but ours mixed in with other NASA stuff. So to date, this was the most watched NASA event. And we had lots of coverage. We got coverage on TV. We had coverage in many different newspapers. The newspapers from the Twin Cities covered what our team was up to, for instance. The Wall Street Journal had us in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not sure which team that was, but that was mentioned a couple days before the eclipse. So that was cool. And then here's some partnerships. So Google Loon Worldview, that's the one I was trying to remember. They're on the verge of allowing people to go into the stratosphere and take a look around when they come back down. Raven Industries, which makes balloons, Stream, which was doing the website stuff. And then we worked closely with the FAA and also NASA, which does have a balloon program office, and they were the ones who actually had to sign off on what we were trying to do. And after Montana Space Grant landed a balloon in Lake Winnipeg, Canadians were not amused, they backed off on that part of the one of the things. It was the balloon program office that pretty much said, no, don't try to teach people that. Even you guys can't pull that one off. So here's some ground images. So North Medford High School team, they were actually on a boat off of the coast of Oregon, and excited for the fact that they were all seasick, which wasn't much fun, and the fact that they didn't get this back after the eclipse because they lost it, which really wasn't much fun. They did manage to launch and get some video down before it even reached the Oregon coast. That was cool. Here's a picture of the North Dakota Space Grant. They just let go of their balloon, which means the balloon is in the process of snapping right now, which is why it doesn't look spherical. It looks a little bit weird. Here was our team. We decided to launch five balloons, not just one. Most teams did two, and some teams did one, a few teams did three, and I think we were the only people who did five. And so we had this telemetry equipment on three out of our five, and the other two were just supposed to go really high and get the best footage we possibly could. Louisiana State actually went to Carbondale, Illinois. If you know, if you've been paying attention, you might realize that there are actually two eclipses coming to this country. One in 2017 and one in 2024, I believe. They're pretty close together, time-wise. And they both go through Carbondale. So they wanted to go to Carbondale, and they want to go back to Carbondale in a few years and do more balloon launches from there. So that was their choice. And lots of teams went to Kentucky. This particular team was from Kentucky, but they hosted a lot of other teams from around the country. And this is kind of a cute photo. It's a picture taken by the University of Maine of their balloon just after release. As they are in the shadow of the balloon. So this is a pre-eclipse eclipse. Okay, so that doesn't really count. And the reason, of course, it doesn't count is there's not this huge shadow, which means that the entire sky around it is not all black, as it is in a real solar eclipse, but rather it still looks blue. So let's just take a quick look at some pictures. Why don't we turn down the lights now? Thank you. The view was astonishing, so by labeling who these pictures came from, here's one picture from the Colorado Space Grant. You can see outer space here, and then you can see the shadow here, and then you can see in this particular direction. But when you're in the shadow, you see this in all directions, okay, the coloration of the sky. These were taken from the ground. Mostly we weren't looking at the sky, we were looking at the ground, because we were in the sky ourselves. On the other hand, there were people who were definitely taking pictures from the ground. And so basically here is the sun just before full eclipse. And once fully eclipsed, then in fact you start to see the corona. That's actually important because what that means is that unless you have a really good telephoto lens in your camera, and that was not what we were flying, even during the flights, the sun did not disappear. What happened is you could see the corona, so there was still something in the sky, but it just wasn't as bright as it should have been, because the moon was blocking the brightest part. Some people were doing photography in infrared, so this is Paul Verhaegh with an image from near infrared, and I actually have learned a lot from him and do that sort of thing myself. This is the coolest picture. Basically, this is a really good camera, and so you can see the eclipsed sun as well as the Earth, as well as the atmosphere in a single picture. That's just stunning.
How come the sun's so little?
It turns out that the sun is little. You don't really realize that, because when you look at the sun, you shouldn't look at the sun, but it turns out that if you look toward the sun, you can actually cover it up with one finger, okay? And so on these pictures, the sun really looks small, and the moon is quite small, and you need a telephoto before you can actually make it start to look bigger. So this is actually quite realistic. But what happens on a photograph, if you happen to have the sun in a photograph, is it always blows out much bigger than the actual size of the sun, because it overexposes the film. Okay, so you don't really realize how small and bright that object in your photographs is. It really is very small. Okay, and it's kind of it's a coincidence, really, that the moon and the sun are almost exactly the same size in the sky. So that means that one will just barely cover the other. In fact, as the distance between the Earth and the moon continues to grow, as it does, eventually, in some hundreds of thousands of years, there will be no more total solar eclipses. And the reason is the moon will no longer be able to completely cover the sun. But at the moment, it happens. It's just not common. So let me just show you some videos. Here's what I'm going to do. Again, I have these things posted, but we're not going to go to the postings. We had 5 balloons ready to go, and then I launched it. I'm just showing you pictures from videos, and then I will show you the actual videos, some of them. Okay, so we released 2 balloons first, we released 2 more later, and then the very last one we released just before the eclipse, and unfortunately it burst early, so even though we were holding it until the last minute, that was the one that gave us the least amount of data, was the very last one we launched. But these two, this one was at 90,000 feet when the eclipse totality came by. This one was at about 80,000 feet. This one was at about 70,000 feet. This one was at about 60,000 feet. So we really stacked up our balloons. That was the plan. here's a picture of the eclipse approaching. So it's not there yet. So from the 70,000-foot balloon, this is at about 63,000 feet. They go up at about 1,000 feet per minute. So here comes the eclipse in the distance. And then this is within totality. Okay, so I lied. It was about 66,000 feet on that particular balloon. And you see this view in every direction you look, and I'll show you the video in a moment. And this is my favorite picture, actually. This shows after we've passed out of totality and the 70-mile-wide shadow is moving away from us, and there were more clouds in that direction. It was somewhat cloudy where we were. And so we could see the entire thing as it was moving away. That's a very cool picture.
Is there a red in the middle of the totality?
Well, that's a great question. And I was kind of confused by that myself. But it turns out there's a town underneath there. It's a town. So just like when you're flying at night and you see these blotches of light, well, those aren't towns. Well, hey, they're towns. And if those towns are underneath clouds, the clouds will blow above the towns. So that was actually a town where all the streetlights came on because it looked like the sky. Yeah, looked like night. Okay? And then I'll show you this video also. This video, coincidentally, we had one balloon right at 100,000 feet just when it popped, and you could just still barely see that shadow just as it was going over the edge of the Earth. In fact, we had some balloons that went higher than that, too. And then I'll show you some video from a stabilized 360 VR. And so in this particular one, this is taken during totality, but notice the sun is still viewable in the sky. Since it's not a telephoto, you don't see the fact that there's a moon in front of it blocking part of it, but what you're seeing mostly there is just the smudged-out corona. And I'm also going to show you this video. And this is, there's the 33-minute version. I'm not going to show you that. I'll show you the 3-minute version that was put together from all around the country. In fact, I think I will start with that one. So can you give me some lights so I can see my computer screen here? Thank you. I'm going to spend some time showing you some videos. Here we go. So this is the 3-minute montage. Practice launch. Actually, I'll take it back. That was probably a launch, but you couldn't tell that the eclipse was coming because you have to launch these in advance of totality arriving. So what you'll see in these things is they're often spinning. This was actually taken at 45,000 feet, and They actually saw planes above them, which is very unusual. Those were research jets from NASA that were flying 55,000 feet. That was not expected. So what you see up there is a balloon, and then hanging from the balloon are various pieces of equipment, and so now the eclipse is starting to come into view right on the edge there, but notice the curvature here is in the camera. So you're from the South Dakota team. They were in the desert, but I forget where. They were in Wyoming. This is a rather special camera that got a 360 view of sorts, and then what they did is after the fact they compensated for the fact that the balloon was rotating, and you can see the shadow passing right underneath them basically, which means they're in the shadow. So here's an up-looking view, and that is an eclipsed sun. If that was not eclipsed, that would be a really blindingly bright light, and the fact that it's not means that that's a fully eclipsed sun. Decided to be involved in this project in some states, Oregon had 7 teams in their one state, but we had people, in fact people even came in from Alaska and came in from Puerto Rico to get involved in this. Now what I'd like to do actually is show you some footage that was taken from my balloons. So where am I going down? These are short, here we go. So for instance, it shows our 5 balloons, and we're about to launch the first 2 of our 5. Why don't you switch the lights so these are off and those ones are on in the back? You can leave the ones in the back on. Thank you. So what you see here is balloons, parachutes below them, payloads hanging below them. We turned on some sirens, which would make noise, so if they landed, when they landed in cornfields, we would have a better chance of finding them. But anyway, so that was the release of our first 2. You can't tell, but an eclipse has already started. It doesn't look that dramatic until it's very close to totality, but this was well before totality, so that these ones would be at altitude when the eclipse came by.
You released those at the same time, yet they were at different altitudes.
Yeah. So it turns out that those 2 balloons, and this is always the case, well, had different amounts of payload on them, and then what we do is we put different amounts of helium to make it go up at different rates. Okay. And so, yes, indeed, those 2 balloons were released at the same time, but they weren't at the same altitude at when the eclipse came by. Okay, so that was the release of the first 2 of our 5. And then let me just take a quick look at here's... Most of this will be from stack B. So stack B was one of our stacks, and this was, in fact, footage that was coming through the ground. So here is B approaching shadow. And so in this particular case, it wasn't always pointing in the right direction, but when it pointed in the right direction, you could definitely see something coming. Okay? And this is the middle of the daytime, and yet you see essentially sunset or sunrise colors. No audio with these videos. We were just sending only the pictures to the ground. And turns out it was rotating enough that we would see the right thing, shall we say, once in a while. Of course, if you're in the shadow, then there's no wrong direction. So here is also B, but this is B when the shadow is over the top of it. So no matter which direction you look, you see approximately the same image, except the colors. And the colors weren't really changing. It's just that the camera just didn't know what to make of these colors. Okay? And so the colors were really very brilliant gold, but sometimes the camera thought that, man, that should be white, and sometimes it thought it should be gold. And so the camera was struggling a little bit. But if you watch carefully, you can actually tell that this thing is going all the way around over the course of this video, which is 2 minutes long. I'm not going to play the whole thing. But here we are within the totality itself, in which case you get this view from all directions. So that's why I call this presentation, I guess, sort of a unique or a different perspective on the eclipse. This is not what most people who went and saw the eclipse were able to show after the fact. On the other hand, do bear in mind that we didn't have people up there. These were balloons carrying cameras, and we sent this footage to the ground during flight and also looked at it after the fact. Now, here's the receding shadow, also from stack B. And so basically there you see the shadow. And in fact, it's 70 miles across, and you sometimes see both. You sometimes see the right-hand side, sometimes see the left-hand side, and then you see the glowing clouds in the middle, which is where the town of Grand Island is actually located. We are near Grand Island, Nebraska. So, I want to show you two more videos. No, I think I'm going to show you one more video. No. I'm going to switch computers here and show you a video that is too big to play on the system. Just give me a moment here. Can I get the lights, please? Thank you. Okay, good. So lights off, please. So this is footage from a VR camera. So what this camera allows me to do is it allows me to look in any direction I want to at any moment in time. So for instance, right now I can look up and I can see the balloon, which is going to carry me in a moment. And then I can see the fact that there are some other balloons ready to be launched. Okay, so this actually is... This is not number one and number two, but this is actually number three and number four. So let's just watch this fly. So this is the very beginning of the flight. Again, you'll see, so there it is. Another balloon flying and this one flying both. I can keep my eyes on that if I want to. And then that pesky balloon that didn't work so well is still down there on the ground to be released later. But the nice thing about this particular footage is the fact that I can look in any direction I want to. And so here's what I'm going to do now, is I'm going to proceed farther into the flight. So here we are, we're getting into the stratosphere. And let's see if I can see an eclipse shadow arriving just yet. I'm just looking around the horizon. Don't see it yet. So I'm just going to go a little bit farther in. Let's look. Oh, there, it's coming. Okay. So the idea is, here comes the shadow. And notice that there's some frosting on the lens of the camera. And again, as I look up, now the balloon, which used to be only about the size of those boxes, there's the sun really brilliantly shining, and the balloon is growing a lot. Pay attention to the fact that this is really glaring, because once that glare goes away, that means we are in full eclipse. But it's getting closer. It's getting a little closer yet. Okay, so now it's really just about on top of us. In fact, now that it's on top of us, let me look up again. And there it is. So now the sun is not glaring. So that is an eclipsed sun as best it could be viewed from this particular camera. Okay. So if that's the case, if I go back down here, and now I look in any direction I want to, I should be able to see shadow below me, and then of course sky, dark sky above me, no matter which way I go.
But here's what I want to do, though, is I want to go up and watch the sun come out of the eclipse. And you'll see how it starts to glare right away. Oh, there it is, okay? And so even now, it's way too bright to be looking at it with naked eye from the ground, okay? So it turns out that this would look like a kind of a gloomy day, but 99% coverage of the sun, and it's like, oh, you don't necessarily even notice that it's anything other than a gloomy day. Okay? It does get, there can be weather effects. So now here is that shadow as it's traveling away from us at 1,600 miles an hour across the cloud tops. And again, depending on when you looked, you can see that the town, Grand Island, is over here. I think this is probably Aurora here. What I thought I might do, though, just for fun, I have a little bit more time left, is I'm just going to keep going on this video. And so there it is going over the horizon. There's a whole other town under it right now. Okay? But so now we are actually past eclipse. The eclipse is done. No more eclipse. This is the environment. Okay? So this is what I do, as I help students take things and put them in this environment. And that's my job, and it's a great job. So basically, this particular one now was getting up close to 110,000 feet. And so it really looks like you are in outer space. Let me remind myself of my time. I'm going to look up at the balloon. The balloon is very big now, and it's about to pop. Oops, it's popped. I'm trying to remember the time on this countdown timer.
The parachute on that isn't real big, is it?
So it turns out, oh, there it goes. Well, let's look for the parachute. Okay, so now I can see bits and pieces of balloon, and I can see the parachute there.
Yeah.
And so if I do the following, let me just stop this for a second. And now let me just look around. So there's the parachute. It is inflated. And it turns out, I go a little bit farther, and maybe I can find a slightly better view of the parachute. Yeah, sometimes things get in the way. The parachute on this particular flight was about 7 feet across. Here it is, up here. And it turns out from 110,000 feet, a 7-foot parachute will do squat. There's not enough atmosphere. There is some atmosphere, but there's not enough atmosphere there, okay? And so it turns out you fall down to about 50,000 feet before the parachute really does very much for you. On the other hand, as we're coming down, basically we'll be able to see sort of standard stuff. So let me just play this. And so if I look around, you can look down. Okay, this is Nebraska, not too different from Minnesota. I can see the town of Grand Island over here on the left-hand side. Okay, there it is. That's Grand Island right there. Just for fun, let's see where this thing lands. Okay, so I'm going to skip this footage. Skips back and forth. So here we are coming down. About to hit. Okay, so now you tell me, what is that? That's not corn, that's soybeans. So, let's see. We got two corn and we got two soybeans. And out of five. So two corn and two soybeans, and I will show you what happened to the fifth one next. But let me lights again, I'm going to switch back to my other computer.
How far away did that travel?
So basically, flights can go anywhere from, 0 miles, which is unusual, to 150 miles or so. Could I get the lights on, please? Thank you. And so these particular ones were relatively short flights. They only went about 50 miles or so. So, let me get back to...
The soybean farmer wasn't upset with
me. The soybean farmer was not upset with us, which is good. Here's what I'm going to do. Actually, I have 10 minutes left, and so I'm going to skip over the science data, and I'm happy to come back to the science data if anybody wants to see it. I just want to show you my last slides here. Okay? So just skipping the science data, just a few closing comments about this experience for us. We learned a lot. It was not all smooth sailing. Here was balloon number five.
Oh!
What are the odds of that?
This was not small power lines. This was a
voltage.
146,000 volt line, if I remember correctly, above the cornfield. But so it didn't hit the corn. But anyway, that was a nuisance. But gosh, we would do this again.
Did you get it back?
We did get it back. Basically, we talked to the power company, and their idea was, well, once this corn isn't here, like in 6 months, we'll go and get it out for you. And I said, you know, that thing is not going to survive 6 months of being out exposed to the weather. Yeah. And so I talked the farmer into letting them drive their big trucks out in the middle of the summertime and getting it back. I really appreciate the farmer.
So that was nice.
Handy. We did get it back. So anyway, it was an interesting experience. And like I said early on, we weren't really in it for the science. You know, I should actually just show you. Sorry. Here are logos for the leadership teams, in particular the Louisiana Space Grant and the Montana Space Grant. And you can certainly look up information about this event on their websites as well as on my website. And then acknowledgements, lots and lots of people involved. And so at the bottom there, it actually mentions a lot of different companies, including Worldview at Raven and Google Luna. I already mentioned that. The Ubiquity, we were using their radio equipment. NAL, we were using their GPS equipment. Kalons, we were using their balloons, etc.
Did Oregon have so many balloons just because it was the place that hit first?
Yes, indeed. Oregon and South Carolina were the places that the eclipse was passing over first and last, and so they had more luck than maybe some of the rest of us in getting people interested in being involved. And so Oregon in particular had like seven different teams from Oregon, and another seven teams from outside of Oregon, including the Alaska team, went to Oregon to do their experience there. So, again, I have some science slides, but I would be happy, in fact, I would prefer to take questions now, and if I don't get to the slides, fine, or if anybody wants to stick around and see some science, more information, I think, please.
Sorry.
Okay? How about the back there?
How do you know that
it's not on someone's car or someone's head? I don't, although it turns out there are not very many cars or heads in Nebraska. But no, it's a good point. it's a good point. And so it turns out that these payloads are inside of styrofoam boxes, and they're not very heavy, and they come down at a modest rate because of their parachutes. And so if it landed on your car, it would not damage your car. If it landed on your head, you would notice it, but it would not damage your head. In fact, you might even get out of the way, and the reason is if they're screaming at you as they're coming down, you might say, oh, that's not good, you know, I'm over here. Okay, so I've never had any interactions of that sort that have caused any trouble. In fact, I've never had any interactions of that sort, but I don't even worry about that. Okay. Is someone else over here have a question? Yeah.
Are you making plans for 2024?
I'm not. And the reason I'm not is because the students that I need to do the project are not willing to stick around until 2024. They haven't arrived yet, the 2024 students. I will make plans when I'm closer to 2024. In the meantime, I'm making plans to do lots of other fun things that will keep me busy. 2024 comes around, I'll be back out there probably doing more balloon. Okay? Yes?
Are there eclipses between now and 2024 in other parts of the world?
There are. It turns out that for this particular eclipse, there was a big effort to generate eclipse glasses and distribute them to lots of people, and then efforts to collect those glasses and send them to Peru, I think, because of an eclipse going on down there. So yes, indeed, if you are willing to travel, indeed, outside of this continent, you might be able to go find an eclipse most any year, perhaps one or two in any given year, often over the water. But yes, indeed, there will be other ones. And in fact, we were a little annoyed. There was somebody, I won't name names, but there was somebody at NASA who heard about this project and poo-pooed it and did not support us and then promptly snuck off to Malaysia to do the same project at an earlier eclipse.
Oh my.
Anyway.
So this is sort of a fun fact. This was the first eclipse to pass over the United States at a time when there was a lot of solar energy being generated, particularly in the state of California, where I live.
Okay.
And we actually, in California, had a big problem.
Sort of a brownout or whatever?
Well, I happen to have about 250 solar projects that I manage and monitor.
Okay.
And we had to basically let our clients know, and the California Independent System Operator had to do an alert throughout the state, even though we were far off.
You were not in the path of totality.
There was enough reduction and insulation that there were active efforts to reduce loads during the period of the crossover to make sure that it didn't disrupt the grid. And as we get more solar around the country, and these eclipses come, this is going to be an increasingly important part of grid management.
I will admit that.
So that's a research problem that maybe you might want to look at.
Okay, I had not thought about that. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Question in the back.
What was your experience like on the ground?
So what was my experience like on the ground? And the answer is we were worried. And the reason we were worried is because we had these balloons flying, and they were doing their thing, but we really wanted to see it too. And it was cloudy, and unfortunately, it was not only cloudy where we were, or sort of scattered clouds, but there were scattered clouds for a day's drive away, and so we couldn't even outrun the clouds if we wanted to, and so we decided to stay put. And as soon as we finished launching, we had five balloons, and I had about 20 people at the launch site, and then I had people in several different locations, fixed locations on the ground, who were picking up the transmissions, and everybody at the launch site scattered, looking for clear skies, and so I ended up with one student, and I don't know where the other 18 were, and I don't really care, and we got clear skies. So in other words, we had a great experience on the ground, but it was really dicey right up to the last minute. So we were literally driving around looking for, where can we see that thing without the clouds in the view at the moment? And it turned out that you couldn't have done that in certain parts of the country where there's lots of traffic and gridlock and whatever, but in Nebraska, after the eclipse, there was lots of traffic and gridlock, but during and before the eclipse, there was not, and we were able to get around fairly well, and there were more clouds down eclipse from us, not down wind, but down eclipse from us, so we actually drove towards the eclipse, and we all found clear enough skies that we got a good look at it.
Yeah, we drove to Eastern Oregon, down to Tally.
Okay.
And, you know, what you presented here is really, really cool from that perspective, but it's so... You know, for people who didn't see it, it is so unbelievable when you're staring up at it. It just kind of cuts you to the core. You just can't believe you're looking at it.
No, I completely agree, and I tried taking some pictures of it, although I didn't have anything fancy on me, and my camera on my phone had no clue what to do with it. I couldn't do it justice at all. It was a great experience.
Yeah, it was just looking at it.
It was a really stunning experience on the ground. Yes?
You kind of mentioned there were some research planes flying. How was the FAA managing any of the airspace? It kind of looked like a free-for-all.
It was not free-for-all. The FAA was very busy. And so we had some people appointed to contact the FAA about all 50 of our locations, essentially. And they were going to contact us through those people. And it didn't happen, but it could have happened. They were very busy, but it was not a free-for-all. They were trying to do what they could. But it turns out that what we were doing was not actually technically under their control or jurisdiction. And so everything that we did in behalf of helping them, like having a website where they could look us up and stuff like that, we did that all because we wanted to, not because we had to. And as far as I know, there weren't any problems, but there was lots of traffic, you know, much more so than any previous eclipse event, for instance, and that too is only going to get worse in some sense, but the FAA deals with the problem, and frankly, they're rewriting some of their rules, including rules for ballooning, and some of those rewrites may impact whether we can even try to do it this way again. Do you have a question?
Do you do atmospheric research too with the balloons, or what other types of balloons?
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to hold on that question for 2 minutes, and then I'm going to answer it. And the reason is I have a bunch of science slides from many of the groups that did atmospheric research and all those sorts of things. I just haven't shown you the slides yet, but I'm just wondering if before we're technically done at 4 o'clock, if anybody else has any other general questions, I'll come back to you.
I bought a couple of photographs that were on the National Geographic site of the shadow in Nebraska.
Okay.
And they're spectacular.
Okay, I think you mentioned that to me before, and I'm not sure who might have taken those, although perhaps National Geographic will tell you. But it turns out that, yes, we came away with lots of stuff from all across the country, including in Nebraska. Hopefully they could sell you more photographs. Anyway, now I've got great footage of
the National Geographic website.
Okay, that's cool. Thanks very much. Any other final questions? And then I'm going to answer some science questions here.
Yeah, as far as research from this, as far as the sun, did we learn any core things that maybe we didn't know before? So many people looking at the sun.
It turns out that there was an effort, and I don't know how it turned out, but the effort was to have people take pictures of this event all the way across the country and then work them into a movie. And so the idea is, when you see the eclipse sun, you can sometimes see certain features on it that are sticking out, in particular beyond the moon. But if you only have your one view and 2 minutes worth or 3 minutes worth from your one view, you can't learn a lot. But if you could actually get several hours worth from people taking similar pictures all across the country. And so I know there was an effort to collect such pictures, but I haven't heard if they ever put them together, and if they did, what they learned, if anything. But that was an attempt to sort of crowdsource some of the science.
Yeah. Isn't it the corona that there, you know, that's what there's least known about the sun?
The corona is one of the parts of the sun that's pretty mysterious, especially why it's so hot. The corona is much hotter than the surface of the sun, for instance. And so the way in which the corona evolves and changes in time might be visible from people with different perspectives, as well as anything that's sticking out, prominences and stuff sticking out from the sun itself. So there were people who were working this project and trying to do very serious science. This is more of a PR stunt. A very complicated PR stunt. Okay. Let me do the following. Thanks again, everybody, for coming. I'm going to actually show you a couple slides here from some of the science results. You're going to collapse and give a final one. So anyway, so here's some science results. And so, for instance, and I won't claim even to understand all of these things, but it turned out that there are such things as meteorological gravity waves. Okay, essentially, these are waves that travel through the atmosphere because of disturbances, and I don't like the name, and the reason is I think of astronomical gravitational waves, and that's a whole different beast. Okay? But it turns out that when you have this shadow traveling through the atmosphere, you can actually disturb the atmosphere, and this was the first time that people seriously went looking to see if this kind of a disturbance would produce this kind of waves, and they said they saw it. Okay? And that's cool. And so basically what they're doing here is, at different times, they're watching what's going on at different altitudes, and they're saying, here's this feature, and notice this feature is visible some of the time, and it disappears some of the time, and that ties in with when the eclipse is going on. So, that was cool. I don't claim to understand exactly. This, on the other hand, I do understand better, because I was involved in doing some of this myself. And this was watching the intensity of light at different wavelengths, from the infrared through the red, orange, yellow, green, and then into the ultraviolet. So the idea is, if I just look at one of these things here, what we have here is altitude in this direction and brightness in this direction, and the fact that this is going up and down and up and down just means that this detector is sort of spinning, and sometimes it sees the sun and sometimes it doesn't. And the fact that the sunlight is going down and down and down means the sun is getting eclipsed, and then after the eclipse happens, then it comes back again. But what they did is they were doing this in all the different ranges so as to understand how does the intensity of the sun vary, not only as a function of altitude, but it's a function of color.
But it doesn't, like the red doesn't mirror the infrared, or the second one there is basically a mirror image, one to the other. Where after the eclipse, the red is all over the map. Why is that?
That I don't know. Again, this is not my data, but I always find something similar to this. And it turns out that my data was worse than this, because my data, this is coincidental. Okay, you're going to laugh, you're going to cry. And that is, my data, okay, it went down until it got eclipsed, and then it never came out of eclipse.
Oh.
And it's like, here's what happened. The balloon got so big that eventually my sensors were in the shadow of the balloon.
In the shadow.
And so even though the sun came back, the balloon didn't let them see the sun anymore.
Oh man,
I should have thought that one through more carefully. Okay, but yes, indeed, you've got a good point that here, basically, these spikes that are above that point, I don't believe those. Okay. It looks like that sensor is not doing well.
Okay.
On the other hand, it's interesting to look at this particular sensor, and the idea is this sensor seems to be sort of maxed out, and so the idea is it was only after the sun was quite a bit covered up before it was even able to start showing diminishment, because it wasn't able to go high enough, probably, or something like that, and then the same thing here. And so in this particular case, actually, the eclipse came by when they weren't even that high. In my case, I actually had the diminishment up to a much higher altitude, and it never came back to that point good, so I didn't get such a nice data as that.
Yeah, but some of those lines are almost straight, and others I have more of a curve, like the red one.
You know, I need to contact Paul Verhaegh about that and see what he thinks about how well his sensors were doing. And so I don't have an answer to the interpretation, but that's exactly what this is all about, is collecting data in a very interesting situation environment, and then trying to see what it tells you. And some of the things it tells you is that there are dropouts. And this, too, I don't really buy the fact that this thing here was sort of so consistent before. And then it almost looks like this device was getting too cold or something like that, and therefore it was struggling to take good data. It's got really fine, yes.
Excuse me. I mean, the scattering amplitude itself is going down substantially as you reach zero intensity. Why is that exactly? Sorry about my voice.
No, that's fine. Okay, so here's the deal, and that is, I mean, here's the sun, and you're getting this kind of light essentially from all the bits and pieces of the sun, and then if I just cover up many of those bits and pieces, you can't possibly get all the light. In fact, if I cover up half of the sun, you might expect that all of your numbers would go down by half. That's it. So the fact that this is diminishing, if I just look at the highest numbers here, suggesting that's when it's pointing most directly at the sun, this is telling you essentially about how much of the sun is covered up, and then the idea is how much of the sun gets uncovered again.
Now, I mean, superficially it looks as though the width of the envelope, you know, is decreasing more rapidly than the
envelope. This here?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's a good point. So what's happening in this particular case is this is when it's pointing as directly as it ever did towards the sun and as far away from the sun as possible, although I'm not going to claim that it was pointing exactly at the sun, even in this case. But yes, indeed, what's happening here, I think, if I look at this one, is it's almost independent. So guess what? There's a sun, there's a very bright sun over there, and it's getting covered up. But if I look over here, there's nothing over there. Nothing getting covered up. That's just the sky. And so the idea is when I'm looking in this direction, it doesn't really matter if there's an eclipse or not. It just looks like the sky, and the sky is kind of over there. Okay? Yes?
I think this paper that you just finished, it was a summer camp called Summer Academy at Minnesota.
Oh, yes. I know about them because I've been there. That's in Columbia Heights, right?
Columbia Heights?
Is that where it is?
Yeah. Close, I think close.
Sure. No, I visited that academy upon occasion, but anyway, go ahead.
So, there were these older kids that, like, they could, they had to make these rockets and they had to try to launch them as high as they could go.
Okay. It turns out that I actually sent some of my students to that academy a couple weeks ago to talk about hovercraft. But yes, indeed, I know that there's at least a class in that same academy that does physics, and in that physics class, for instance, I think they build and launch rockets. I've never talked to them about rockets, but I could have. It's something I really love to do, too. That's cool. I'm glad to hear that.
We like to watch them.
That's good. Okay, here's another thing. This is spectrometer data, so essentially it's showing you colors this way, and intensity. And then the idea is what they chose to do is they chose to take every 5 minutes, draw new plots. The idea is this and this and this and this and this. Are different times, and so frankly what you'll notice is that at different times you're getting different kinds of features, and in particular at this one time here, so this would be totality, so at that one time you're essentially not getting any intensity at any of the colors, and then when you're off of totality. But what they were specifically looking at, and they had marked them with these vertical lines, is the fact that there's certain notches in this spectrum, and I don't remember, again, this is from a presentation that was given at a conference that I was running at the conference. But they were saying that by looking at where those notches are, they could learn something about the way in which this event is fundamentally impacting the kind of light that's available in the sky. I just don't know too many details for that. This was interesting. What they were trying to do here, this is Weber's statement, I do remember them talking about this, is they were saying, look, the reason the stratosphere is warm is because there is ozone in the stratosphere. And then as sunlight comes in and interacts with the ozone, it actually essentially gets absorbed by certain parts, certain layers of the atmosphere, and it warms up. And so if that's the case, what should happen during an eclipse, when you don't have this incident light, is that you should have a change in the production of the ozone, and hence possibly, maybe not changes in overall temperatures. And so they went looking for whether they could watch for decreased ozone production by watching ozone as a function of altitude during flights, both during and prior to and after the eclipse, and they couldn't see it. They went looking for something, and that little bar there says, this is what we were sort of thinking might be the size of the effect, and frankly, things are bouncing around so much that they couldn't convince themselves that anything of that size really was happening. But it was worth trying. Here are some pictures from a group that had a specific special camera mount, and they were also using one of these VR cameras, and they were able to see it. So these were actually individual still photos from what was a video, not too different from what I had for it. What else have I got? Oh yeah, so here are pictures from two different groups, in fact, taking a look at the corona. This actually was using the Raspberry Pi cameras, not in the way I was using them. But in one particular case, they were looking at it with just regular visible light, and then in one case they were looking at infrared light and trying to see what they could
get from it. It turns out that this was one of these things that they thought after the fact, wait a minute, we should have done that. And then they found someone else who actually did that, and so that's why they're two groups, Wesleyan and Montana State, who have nothing to do with each other, but they both had this one picture, and they said, hey, if we put these pictures next to each other, we might be able to learn something. I was involved in this one at least a little bit. It turns out that the radioactivity in the upper atmosphere and in outer space is really nasty. Yes?
Why are the colors so weird? Like there are really bright colors with some...
In which other... Are you talking about the colors in some of the pictures? It turns out... Okay, I'll get back to my radioactivity story in a second. When the sun shines on the atmosphere, it has a tendency to go right through the atmosphere, okay, and that's why if you look right at the sun, which you should not do, it will be really, really bright. On the other hand, some of the light that isn't heading for you but actually strikes the rest of the atmosphere gets scattered by particles in the atmosphere, and it ends up going in a direction not exactly the original direction, and the blue colors get scattered more widely and the red colors not so much. So what happens if you have like a sunrise or a sunset is the sun is close to the horizon, and then most of the sun is coming through a rather thick amount of atmosphere, and it starts to look orange or red or gold. On the other end, in the middle of the day, everything looks quite blue, except for right at the sun itself. When you have an eclipse, it's almost like you have the sunset or the sunrise, but it's all around you, in every direction you look. And then if you're in the stratosphere, you can see the same effect. So the best way to think about why the color is so weird is it's almost like a sunrise or a sunset. It's just it's a funny place that you can see that from the ground, and you can see that from the upper atmosphere. We were not so concerned about cloud cover because we were going to be above the clouds, at least our cameras were. But we wanted it to be cloud-free or not too cloudy at least so that we could see some of these effects, and we eventually were able to, but it was fortunate there were at least some clouds because our footage was better in the places there were clouds, we could see more contrast. In the places that there was a dark shadow on dark ground, we couldn't see it very well. And so dark shadow on bright clouds, we could see it really well. But yeah, the colors are astonishing. They're very cool. And you see them in many more directions than you expect. Back to radioactivity, it turns out that the upper atmosphere and the outer space is rather radioactive. The first thing the United States sent into the outer space was a Geiger counter to measure radiation, and it was so radioactive it killed it. That was our first experience with space flight, was putting something into outer space and outer space killed it. And we thought maybe we screwed up, and we didn't. In fact, they put more on and they realized it's really nasty up there. What you find on balloon flights is what's going on here is altitude in this direction. We often put altitude this way because altitude is vertical, even though it's not necessarily the dependent or independent variable. And then this is radioactive level. And so the idea is when you're at low altitudes, you don't have much radiation. And then the radiation increases a lot, and then it tends to sort of settle down and start to decrease, not because there's really less radiation, but because you're getting less scattered particles and you're getting more of high power, high energy particles here. But this peak, okay, is referred to as the Regner-Fotzer maximum. And so the question that they were exploring is, does that peak, the location in the atmosphere where you start to get less numbers, less counts, although you can see it's pretty broadly scattered, vary when an eclipse comes by? And they think they saw it, but it's a small effect, and so it's hard to convince people when you have this much scatter in your data. But that I was actually involved a little bit in that particular part of the project. This is my last slide, yes. And that is NASA Ames. Has been doing the following. They've been interested in understanding bacteria in stratospheric conditions, and so they noticed that there were going to be 50 teams, more than 50 in fact, flying more than one balloon each, most of them. And they said, couldn't we send along some bacteria for the ride? This has nothing to do with the eclipse. They just really wanted to understand, in such a big event, what's going on at different parts of the stratosphere with bacteria. And so I didn't actually carry any of these things myself, but they send out these little tiny slides to people. You're supposed to keep them really clean, and then just before you fly them, you're supposed to expose them and let them go all the way up there. And then, unfortunately, a lot of them, when the thing landed, you know, it contaminated it, but they did at least get some data out of it. They call that their MicroStrat project. And they kind of just took advantage of the fact that we were going to be flying balloons in this event anyway. And so, again, I haven't yet, it's too early, in fact, to know the answers to this, but this particular presentation was, here's what we did, and we collected some data, and we'll get back to you about what we think it means. Yes?
Just on your previous slide, you mentioned that maybe they had seen a change in the maximum.
The altitude at which that maximum occurs.
Yeah, these are college undergrads, right?
It's college undergrads working with college faculty members who are doing the experiments. That's true.
Okay. So I was thinking about things like the quality, the data quality is dependent on a lot of things, including the instrument quality and the calibration and all that other stuff. And I just wondered if
No, that's a good point. And there's lots to be learned here. But one of the things to be learned here is that when you're doing things that are radioactivity experiments, the data is fundamentally statistical in nature, and so it's not bad quality data. It's just that's the kind of experiment you're doing. Sometimes you get more counts, and sometimes you get less. So you have to do lots of statistical analysis to figure out what's going on here. But
it really applies across the whole list of things you did. I just want
to that's absolutely true. Okay, but it turns out that in this particular case, what happens is that these primary particles are coming in. They're interacting with the atmosphere, and they're scattering, and they tend to interact with the atmosphere based on pressure. And so what happens is when you have this big shadow, it cools the atmosphere and the entire atmosphere kind of hunkers down, and hence the pressure at which this should start to happen actually gets lower physically. And they were trying for the first time to actually see if they could measure the fact that these particles were managing to penetrate deeper into the atmosphere before they did so much scattering. There have been some studies done during eclipses from the ground, but notice you're almost at zero on the ground, and so that's not the best place to be doing the experiment. On the other hand, you can't have balloons at every altitude at this perfect time. They had a few balloons, and they had some on the way up and some above the maximum. And so they still have some things on their hands to try and figure out what it all means. But their preliminary claim was that they thought they saw the thing did hunker down, possibly half a kilometer or so, which is visible on this graph. Yep.
Well, back in, a long time ago, when people listened to AM radio, I mean, I remember the sort of idea that the ionosphere lowers at night, and that some radio station seems to, or does it go up or, but anyway, you tend to get a 50 kilowatt station broadcast over the entire country essentially at night.
Sure.
Something similar could have happened here during the eclipse, and is anybody looking for those types of effects?
That's a great idea, and I don't know that anybody was in the project that I was involved in actually was doing that kind of radio testing. But yes, indeed, that could make some sense. I mean, it turns out that when they have these, what is the temperature of the atmosphere as a function of altitude? They really should say, and they never do, in the daytime. And the reason is the temperature versus altitude is completely different at night. And like you pointed out correctly, radio transmission will vary depending on weather conditions and, in particular, day-night conditions. But I don't know that anybody that I was working with was actually actively trying to watch for variations in radio capabilities. We missed that. Yeah.
I'm sorry to ask you this, but at the beginning you mentioned these meteorological gravity waves, and these are waves in what?
These are actually big, very large-sized pressure disturbances in the atmosphere itself. Okay, and they are. I don't know a lot about them, but they are instigated by certain kinds of weather patterns. It turns out that we're above most classical weather, and yet apparently what goes on in the stratosphere is important to how weather operates, because every time the Weather Service tries to get rid of their ballooning program and only use surface information and satellite information, things go really badly wrong. Knowing what's going on at 90,000 feet seems to be quite important to their weather models, even though there doesn't seem to be much weather at 90,000 feet.
That's why we call them gravity waves.
I don't really know where that name comes from, and like I say, as an astronomer type, that kind of bugs me. Okay, hey, crappy, that's mine. But no, these are meteorological disturbances, and they're related to, sometimes, I believe, they get established by certain kinds of weather patterns, and they also get established by weather flows over certain kinds of surface features, like mountain ranges, and so the idea is downrange from a mountain range, you can sometimes see these waves getting shed, and you can pick them up downrange. So the question was, could they watch for these things and see them being generated and propagated based on this particular object, this thing, this shadow that is moving across at a very specific time of day on a very specific date? And their claims, they saw something. But I don't know the details. I'm sorry. It's not my expertise. Well, I've kept you far over time, but thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
And,
appreciate it.
Enjoy the rest of your time at home.
First of all, how expensive is something like that?
That was pretty pricey. It turns out that was lent to us by someone who wanted to make a movie from our footage, and so I'm not even allowed to post that, but I'm allowed to show that footage. GoPro cameras, just sort of as a starting point, they're expensive cameras. They range from $200 to $400, and then there are other cameras that are kind of GoPro knockoffs that are less than $100.